Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on July 3, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Vatara Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches five strengths to be developed and maintained that directly supports integration of the Eightfold Path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So the Vatara Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches five strengths that are developed and maintained that support a life well integrated with the Eightfold Path. And beginning with the first strength the Buddha teaches, and it's interesting that it's the first one, is conviction. And it speaks directly to the understanding that the Buddha did not teach any type of faith-based religion. Nothing needs to be taken on faith. In fact, the Buddha discouraged taking anything that he taught on faith. He taught that if you're going to develop awakening as he teaches it, it must be directly experienced. And so there's nothing faith-based, there's nothing dogmatic, meaning that there's no authoritarian position taking without any foundation. The foundation is our own experience. There's an article on the website with a couple of talks called Sada, A Question of Faith. Sada means faith or conviction, depending on how you look at it, an old Pali term. And the point of that whole article was how the Buddha's Dhamma must be experienced directly, and that faith would just be another distraction. And that, I think the best example of that, although you could read just about any sutta and see this, is the Buddha's very first teaching when he was walking down the road a few weeks after his awakening, and he came across his five buddies that he had been wandering around northern India seeking enlightenment. And as soon as they saw the Buddha, they realized that he had found the answer that they were all seeking. He achieved an awakened state. And then as soon as he spoke and gave that very short sutta on the Four Noble Truths, they were immediately convinced and then were able to engage in his Dhamma through conviction rather than just imaginary promises that the Buddha would say, if you do this or do that, or even if you act in a certain way, you'll be rewarded for your actions. Again, the Buddha never taught that. He taught the moral and ethical aspects of the Eightfold Path primarily to recognize when we're engaged in the unskillful action, so simply so we can recognize what's occurring in our own minds. In other words, our thinking in the Buddha's Dhamma is much more important than the result, meaning our actions, the result of our thinking, because the Buddha understood that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that leads to a wrong way of thinking, and it's that thinking that must be addressed, not simply the actions. And that speaks to another one of these strengths. So let me read the sutta. The Buddha addressed those gathered. Friends, there are five strengths needed for developing the Dhamma: conviction, conscience, concern, persistence, and insight. Most of this is taken from Thanissara Bhikkhu's excellent translation. The change that I made, the significant change, is that he used the word perception rather than insight here. I was thinking about another sutta that I did the same thing the next week. But and insight, I think, is much more direct. Actually, he used the word discernment rather than insight. But insight speaks directly to what the Buddha is teaching, to gain insight into the three marks of existence. So I think it's a more appropriate use of that word. The Buddha continues, one who is developing the Dhamma has conviction through understanding. They understand that the Buddha is a rightly self-awakened one. They understand that the Buddha, consummate in knowledge and conduct, is an expert with regard to the conditions of the world. They understand that the Buddha is unsurpassed as a teacher to those fit to be taught. This one has strength of conviction. So, much like there might be a college subject that you want to learn, and you would do your due diligence, and you would first probably look at the school, the university, and then you might look at the professors, and finally then kind of winnow that down to a professor that you think really represents what you want to learn. And then you would, with conviction, not on faith, take that course. Well, this is really the same thing. The Buddha always held himself out as a rightly self-awakened one. He used that term over and over and over and over again. So people understood that they too could become rightly self-awakened, that it wasn't something that he or any outside agency could impose on you, that it wasn't just through your actions, but it was through changing the way that you think about yourself in relation to the world, gaining insight into the three marks of existence, that any human being could awaken. He continues, one who is developing the Dhamma has a strong conscience. They feel shame at engaging in bodily misconduct or verbal misconduct or mental misconduct. So that is, this is not a way of self-flagellation, oh, I did something wrong, let me whip myself 100 times. It's not that type of shame. It's recognition of the hurtfulness of your own thoughts, words, and deeds. Again, a key component of the Eightfold Path, isn't it? And again, just to emphasize, it's not there to beat ourselves up, to recognize that we're awful persons. It's simply to recognize what aspects of our thinking and our actions need to be recognized and abandoned. What aspects of our thinking and our actions are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. One who is developing the Dhamma has strong concern for the suffering of others and for their own bodily misconduct or verbal misconduct or mutual or mental misconduct. So we don't just, it's not just a selfish path. And this is where the underlying bodhisattva understanding is, that we're doing this for everyone. The difference in the Buddha's understanding of a bodhisattva and modern Buddhism's application of bodhisattva, which is really substituting the bodhisattva path for the Eightfold Path, is that the Buddha understood that we must first address our own ignorance if we're to be of any help or any service to anyone. So those of us that are really concerned about what's going on in the world today will take to the Dhamma, because in that way we can be an example of how an awakened person thinks and acts in any condition, in any situation. That's the type of conscience and conviction and concern that the Buddha's talking about.
That would be unwavering.
Unwavering, yeah. That's
right, the middle way.
Yeah, that's
anything
the right
else,
word.
Anything else, you might be doing nice things, but not necessarily.
Yeah.
Put it in the path. It could get you in trouble.
Think about, again, I don't like to bring this up, but it's such a great example, the rhetoric in this country right now. And the both sides, and now the extreme views that are being expressed are coming from people that are compassionate and maybe too passionate about their views. They think they're doing the best thing for each other, but their views are so polarized that they've lost the middle way. They've lost the understanding of other people and their suffering. And I'm not talking about just one side or the other. That's such a good example. When our conviction, our conscience, and our concern for each other is unwavering, we couldn't take an extreme position against anything, could we? The Buddha never did that. Even when coming up against murderers, Angulimala comes to mind. He never chastised, and I've read the sutta so many times because, in fact, just recently, because I was looking at this. He never directly said, Angulimala, you're a piece of garbage, or some of the other rhetoric that we might use today. Or you're this or you're that. He told this bloodthirsty murderer, it's your thinking that is destroying you. He, out of concern for Angulimala's well-being, and then taking that outside of what Angulimala is capable of, Frank.
They don't know they're suffering.
Pardon me?
They don't know they're suffering.
That's the point, yes.
They don't know they're suffering, and they don't know their own suffering.
And that's just what the Buddha is referring to here.
And they don't,
we must understand other people's. Pardon me?
They don't know there's a way to get rid of their suffering. Yeah. Because they don't recognize that they're suffering.
Yes. And so when we have concern. When we have concern for others' bodily, mental, and verbal misconduct, that the Buddha means we understand where it's coming from. So we don't react. We have concern for that. It doesn't. So it can't generate hate. Or even a mild form of aversion. We're able to stay present with each other. The Buddha was able to maintain that mind of equanimity no matter what was occurring. When he knew that a murderer had his thinking of killing him next, or when his cousin Devadatta tried to kill him twice, the Buddha never lost it. He never reverted to harmful rhetoric or striking out. When he saw Devadatta's boulder coming down the mountain, he took two steps to the right and he tried to help Devadatta. Devadatta never got it. You know, he still tried to teach Devadatta the Dhamma. Devadatta still continued in his mindless ways. Frank?
I was just going to share something I read the other day. I forget where I read it, but it just said one of the greatest obstacles to waking up is not even knowing that you're sleeping. And if you think about it, it's the truth.
Yeah.
So it was pretty cool.
It is. The Buddha continues. One who is developing the Dhamma has developed strong persistence for recognizing and abandoning unskillful mental qualities and for developing and maintaining skillful mental qualities. They are steadfast and resolute with regard to skillful mental qualities. And so, again, it simply means, and this relates a little bit to next week's sutta on the Tissa Sutta. There's going to be times in our Dhamma practice, and not only in the beginning, when we're uncertain, maybe full of doubt, maybe lethargic. It just doesn't feel like we want to keep going. That's when we need persistence, isn't it? We need to recognize, and how does that type of persistence manifest? Where does it come from? It comes from conviction, doesn't it? I understand that an awakened human being has done this. He's teaching us in a very simple and direct way, or teaching me in a very simple and direct way how to do it. And even when I don't feel like it, when it doesn't feel like it's working, when meditation stinks, or when I just don't feel good about it, I can rest on that conviction, that initial strength, and that will carry me through. And that way you can see conviction is part of that sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, isn't it? Right effort. To simply continue. And then everyone in this room has had, almost from the beginning, an initial experience of the efficacy of this Dhamma. And so that just redoubles, and it strengthens our conviction. It strengthens that initial strength. And so much like going to the gym, you start out, you want to lift 300 pounds. Well, in my case, I'd like to lift 100 pounds again. But you start lifting 25, and you gradually build yourself up. All of these strengths are just the same way, aren't they? Even conviction. It doesn't start with, for most of us, it doesn't start with 100% conviction. It starts with a little bit of conviction. It starts with the understanding, this is a meaning of true refuge, the Ratana Sutta, taking refuge, taking comfort and safety in the understanding that a human being actually did this. And since he did, a rightly self-awakened one, we can do the same. And that's where it all follows from, that understanding. The Buddha continues, one who is developing the Dhamma has strong insight into three marks of existence, and that leads directly to the cessation of stress and suffering. Friends, these are five strengths one who is developing these are five the five strengths one who is developing the Dhamma. So train yourselves. I will develop and maintain the strength of conviction. I will develop and maintain the strength of conscience. I will develop and maintain the strength of concern. I will develop and maintain the strength of persistence. I will develop and maintain the strength of insight. This is how you should train yourselves. It's the end of the sutta. Thank you. So again, just like it speaks to the entire Dhamma. And you know, these suttas like this, to me, are remarkable in the fact of how simple and direct and how practical they are. How do we develop the Dhamma? How do we get out of that massive confusion rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths? Develop these five strengths. How do we develop these five strengths? To integrate the Eightfold Path. Everything points back to that, doesn't it? But then holding this in mind when our practice is wavering and we want to bring it back to an unwavering state of mind, we do it with conviction. We understand this. We understand it's going to work. If I keep doing this, I'm going to awaken. How do we know? Because we can look around us. I mean, one of the great benefits, and I'm going to talk more about this in relation to the Tissa Sutta, one of the great benefits of that third refuge, of having a Sangha, and again, I say it so often, we're so fortunate to have the Sangha that's developed here, is we can look at each other and know that it's working, because we see it in each other. And we talk about it in every class. Again, we're not taking anything on faith, are we? And we're supported by each and every one of us. Not, it's not just me. And the Buddha relied on his Sangha in much the same way. Even right from the beginning, when remember the story on Sariputta and Moggallana, as soon as the Buddha realized their awakened, fully mature state, he then could gain strength from them and rely on them to support the other members of the original Sangha. And even as Tissa Sutta next week, I'm going to give the sutta tonight. The Tissa Sutta comes from Tissa and telling other members of the original Sangha about his uncertainty and his displeasure for the Buddha's Dhamma. And they didn't try to mollify him or pacify him. You know, oh, you'll be okay. Everything is wonderful. Everything's for a reason. They simply said, go talk to the Buddha, because that's not our experience. That's how all of this comes together in this great sutta. So again, thank you for the additional speech. Any questions or comments on this sutta, and we'll go around the room. Yes, Lorna.
I think one of my strengths of why I keep coming to class is more curiosity. I'm just curious.
A sixth strength.
Well, I was just wondering if being just curious of how quiet you can get your mind in meditation. I'm just curious how I can see my own mind getting rooted on a certain thing to develop, you know, my thoughts and feel that I have a anatta, I am a person, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's really curiosity, I think, that sort of drives me. And I was just wondering if that fitted into one of the five sections that you've just gone through.
Oh yeah, I would say it fits in all of them, particularly with insight and the desire or the curiosity to understand what's going on with me in relation to the world. But also there's a word, chanda, which means skillful desire. And so you can certainly call curiosity towards the Dhamma as a skillful desire to understand. And even that follows from conviction, doesn't it? Because I remember when you first came to class in Flemington.
At Flemington, yeah.
You had no idea what this was about.
No idea.
But I think from that first night you got at least an inkling that piqued your curiosity, it piqued your desire. You saw something in this great teacher, or you saw something in the Dhamma that seemed real, that seemed useful.
Yes.
Yeah, so curiosity in that way is certainly one of these strengths. And it rests on that word chanda, skillful desire.
It also rests on a certain conviction that this my curiosity is aimed at something where it's going to find an answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know the other, while you're saying that, while you're both talking, that gives us an initial right view, doesn't it? It gives us a direction. In other words, you're not curious about how the Ten Commandments, I'm not putting it down, you're not curious about how chanting might get you there. You're not curious about how smudging yourself. Now, again, got to keep saying it, I'm not putting any of those things down. Your curiosity was well focused on what a Buddha taught.
Mm-hmm.
And that feeds conviction too, doesn't it? And it feeds all of them, persistence. So yes, as we talked about, I think curiosity is really about that, a well-focused curiosity. So thank you. Frank, you had a question or a comment?
I had the similar thought when I was reading this about the second quality of conscious,
mm-hmm.
how that feeds directly into the initial condition of ignorance of Four Noble Truths, wrong thinking.
Yeah.
And as this thinking develops, and as we see our own shift from wrong thinking into right understanding, our own understanding of our own experiences, how that shift from that conscious mind and from wrong thinking, it feeds into that general concern for other people as we can really start to develop an understanding of our own suffering, our own pain and suffering, then we can understand others.
Yeah, wow, thank you for that. And again, it's just a practical teaching on how to recognize when you're acting or thinking in unskillful ways. the Buddha's really saying something like the Jiddu Krishnamurti often said, look at the lives you're living, look at the way you're thinking. And if you're acting in hurtful ways towards others or towards yourself, and you don't feel any shame, there's something wrong there. Right? And even the subtle aspects of doing that, excusing away behavior because someone else is getting me upset. You know, it's so common today. That's justification for hatred, isn't it? But it was just as common during the Buddhist time. Using this well-integrated Dhamma, we can't excuse those things away in our own mind, can we? Because we have a framework for holding them in mind, for seeing them clearly. There's no opportunity to say, oh, this type of behavior, this type of thinking is justified because of so-and-so. And why is that so important? It's because it's our thinking that keeps us rooted in ignorance, like Frank just said. It shows us clearly what's occurring in our minds.
I think the whole nature of justification is trying to find a reason for your behavior or an excuse.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or there's like, I remember when I was reading something, I don't know when it was, but when I was like, I realized that feeling justified isn't righteous or a goal or, you know, and I didn't know that before. I didn't realize that I shouldn't be defending myself or defending my, you know, and so you find yourself in justification, and then once you realize certain words like that, you can find yourself that you're off the path. Like, oh, I'm in justification because I'm justifying my behavior because what everybody else is doing, for an example. And you can realize you're off the path, you're in wrong view, and as soon as you know you're in wrong view, you're no longer justifying. Mm-hmm. And it kind of kicks you back on the path.
Wow, thank you. And so, describe the quality of mind before and after, when you're justifying and when you let it go.
When you're justifying, you don't even realize that you're agitated, you know? You've got your armor ready, and you're like, I'm justified, right? And I'm dressed for it.
You're ready for battle.
Right.
There's a heaviness.
Yep, there's a heaviness.
It kind of requires a little bit of self-honesty, and then like that vulnerability yourself to be open to that, like.
Oh yeah, it takes
really
radical honesty.
It happens really on the cushion.
Yep.
When you're in meditation, I think.
It happens from that well-concentrated mind that's able to not be distracted by its own justification,
right.
because to catch it.
Introspective awareness.
Yep.
Yeah.
And boy, that's there you go. Introspective awareness. I'm gonna.
And the other aspect of that is the people you surround yourself with. Because if they're justifying your behavior or you're catching the fire of their justification, you're way off the path.
It's the Akamamilo. Like, he justified his way down the path, and the Buddha showed him that there was a next moment where he couldn't be on the path, and I'm sure he felt absolutely weightless.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it's almost put that way in the sutta, isn't it? And up until that moment, just in Angulimala's mind, Angulimala was a bloodthirsty murderer who had a reputation for doing that, and he had, up until that point, he had killed 99 people, and he cut off a finger of each one and made this bloody necklace that he walked around, so everybody knew who he was and lived in fear of him. And the thought that allowed him to justify the next one was, I need an even 100. Just that thought alone. But it took the Buddha's Dhamma and shining the light of true wisdom onto Angulimala's thinking that then allowed him to let all of those go. Even that hardened view that would, in his mind, justify murder simply vanished when he came across the Dhamma. And what a great description of that, too, of justifying. And don't we do that? And I don't think there's any murderers in this room, but even if there are, by the way, the Dhamma will change your mind about that. But in little and subtle ways, we've done things that are hurtful towards ourselves and others, and we justified it because of the environment that we're in or the views that we're holding. And Helen bringing up the associations. How often do we get caught up in the mindlessness of association because everybody else is doing it? And that can lead to, whether it's social violence or just continued distraction and ignorance within a so-called spiritual practice, because everybody else is doing it this way. I did that for many, many years. You know, I did all kinds of practices that I now know that the Buddha said don't do it only because they're continued distraction, but I did it because everybody else was doing it, even though I felt kind of foolish doing it. And not foolish because I was embarrassed, foolish because deep inside I knew that this was not what I was looking for, but I did it. Again, I'd be sitting up in, I won't even mention the place, but I'd be sitting in this great monastery in this huge hall with a bunch of people doing rituals that I you know, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, I felt foolish doing. But I did it because everybody else did it. I didn't have a framework for recognizing it then either. And that's, so there's gross and obvious applications of the Dhamma that we can all see when we first start developing the Dhamma. And then as we continue, as Lorna's talking, as we're all really talking about, because of a well-concentrated mind, we're able to develop that refined mindfulness to ever increasingly subtle levels of understanding. Until eventually we get to what the Buddha described in the Nagara Sutta. We recognize and abandon all views rooted in ignorance. And then we live a human life in peace and equanimity no matter what's occurring. That's what everybody wants, isn't it? That's what everybody thinks they want when they're seeking. But the Buddha is the guy that figured out how to get it. And then to maintain that quality of mind no matter what's occurring. To no longer need to justify anything. Why? Because now our minds are pure. They're not reactive. They're not stuck in ignorance or rooted in wrong views. Well, what a great discussion. Anybody else? Be okay with it? Maybe we went around most of the room, but we'll do so anyway. So start with Ram. Ram, good to see you.
Excuse me.
Yeah, I see in that last part of the sutta that discernment is not really a right translation. Insight is really what it's about.
Yeah. What does
Tanisaro know? Yeah. Why did
he
use that word?
Pardon me?
Why did he use discernment? What was his?
He used that word a lot. I read some articles where he talks specifically about discernment, so he turns it out a lot.
Yeah, and it's tricky too, because discernment to me means applying wisdom situationally where it's appropriate. And so you could say insight is kind of the same thing there. But in the sutta, the Buddha's talking about the three marks of existence. And so gaining insight into that is what the Dhamma is all about. And also, we can't remember it. We can't forget. I should say, because this is it's going out there to millions. Tanisara Bhikkhu was one of the most brilliant minds in modern Buddhism. And his translations are, I think they're the best and the most reliable. But we also have to remember that he's doing a scholarly and hopefully word-by-word translation from an ancient language, the ancient Pali language, to English. And there's no correlation between a Pali word and an English word. There's very few words that you can say, well, the Pali word is rajara, and the meaning is horse. There's no word like that, including insight or discernment. So you have to have, in order to do a skillful translation, you first have to understand what the Buddha's teaching. And unfortunately, a lot of translations don't really understand the underlying Dhamma. Tanisaro does, but you also can't help but translate it according to what you think the Buddha's saying. And that's going to cloud your the eventual use of the words you use. You could read the same sutta by Tanisaro, by Bhikkhu Bodhi, by Maurice Walsh, by John Ireland, by Christmas Humphreys, etc., 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 and you're going to see some subtle differences, and then you're going to see a completely different sutta by some people. And I might as well go to take this a little bit further. So what I write, when I write out a sutta, and it's primarily based on Tanisaro's translation, sometimes Bhikkhu Bodhi, a few others very occasionally. My focus is to avoid the repetition just because that gets tiresome, but also to keep the wording and the verbiage modern and in context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, which is something that's lost in most of the scholarly translations because they're scholarly. They have their charge is to be more appropriate to the verbiage, the Pali verbiage, rather than the overall context of the Dhamma. And that's exactly how it should be. Because if there wasn't those types of translations, if there wasn't authentic scholarly translations, then everything would just be a mess of interpretation. And that's not true. And again, I would say primarily because of Thanissara Bhikkhu and the website Access to Insight, and now to his website called dhammatalks.org.
Right. And they still refer back to older translations.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Constantly. So they're trying to juggle not just what it means in modern English, but they're referring back to translations into English by people whose primary language wasn't even English.
Yeah, and all that, and also you have to understand the society that the Buddha lived in and why he was speaking to certain things, such as rebirth and karma and what he really meant by that and other things. Richard Gombrich wrote some great books on understanding the underlying background in the true life of the Buddha. I have a cousin of mine, his name is Carl Olson. He wrote a few scholarly books on this too. He's unfortunately, he's another brilliant Haskell, actually. And his writing is really hard to digest, but if you want to get into something, pick up a couple of his books. And again, the none of that, when I first started reading the suttas, I was probably just as confused then as I was prior to that, until I understood, and I kind of remember when this hit me, that everything the Buddha taught was taught in relation to dependent origination and his first teaching, the Four Noble Truths. And then, like on retreat, those next two suttas that he, discourses that he gave. And then when you know that, you can see the consistency throughout all of the teachings. Even this teaching today, if I just gave this, we had no background for it, you would think that the Buddha taught, okay, I just got to get strong in these five things, right? Because you don't understand the underlying teaching of why we need to gain this strength. So in order to understand the Buddha's teachings and to, I would say, interpret and translate it properly, you have to understand the entire context. And then you can apply it in a modern and useful way, which is what I hope to do in my own, you know, I can't call them translations because I'm not really not translating anything except a few words like that. But my own interpretation is based on an understanding of the overall teaching of the Buddha. And so that's where the difference lies. So again, that long speech and maybe this little brief discussion to not denigrate anything that Thanissara does. I mean, it's important. He's remarkable. So, thank you. Lorna.
I want to thank everybody for coming, and I've enjoyed the evening, enjoyed the talk, but I have nothing really to add. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks everybody for being here. David, good to see you tonight.
I really enjoy these little situational suttas, because I was talking to Mary last night, I'm like, it's almost like people kept asking the Buddha, or he overheard, like, I wish you could give me some more examples. I wish you could say another word. Because after the, you know, Four Noble Truths, everything else is commentary.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, so as I was meditating Monday night and this morning, again, it's watching things arise, and it just does give you a deeper understanding of when things arise. Sometimes you just can't place what's arise. It doesn't fall into the hindrances or the, you know, something, seven factors. So the situational sutta, like I like to call it, is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I find them just that way. It gets right to the heart of the matter. And you're so right. And everything after the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first sutta the Buddha ever gave, is really commentary. And it's situational applications of how to develop the Four Noble Truths. Even some of the great suttas, like the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta, are really commentary on what's occurring when you develop the Dhamma and how you do it. Thank you, Dave. Mary, good to see you.
Oh, good to be here. Good to see you. Good to be with everyone. I also like these. There's almost, even though the words are serious words, there's a sweetness to the simplicity and the goodness behind them. I find it really helpful and very practical in terms of the application in our daily lives. I think what happens is we experience some sort of validation that we're on the right path, and just get something that says, "Ooh, I behave differently or better or with discernment or whatever in that situation, and I had more positive outcomes that are demonstrating to me that I'm on the path of happiness." But as you often say, it's as important to use all these factors to identify when you're off the path, when you're not following the Eightfold Path, when you're off the path, and the practice on the cushion and then off the cushion helps you to recognize that, hopefully in the moment, and get you back on the path again, where you're once again validated for the, like, the joy and the engagement that comes from integrating the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So I find these, what are they called?
The strengths.
You know, it's just another little, I'm going to, stick that back here, and that'll come in handy from time to time. And like David said about it being situational, to be able to, as your practice grows, and I think even for all of us, no matter how long you've been doing it, you have these moments when you take giant steps backwards and you lose your mind and you feel like you're starting completely over again, and then you pull out these five strengths or whatever and you're like, okay, and you recognize in the moment what's there and what's not there and get back on the path. So it's like every day, if you're really serious about this and disciplined and right effort and all of that, there's opportunity every day to experience all of that.
Yeah.
The validation, this is good, I'm feeling more happiness, I'm feeling less of this, I'm making better decisions, associations, like Helen said, and these things are all bringing me greater happiness. And then the recognition of your own behaviors that may lead you off that path and that aren't bringing you happiness, but maybe you thought they were, whatever. It's just, it all feeds back to you do it yourself. You do it yourself, you learn it yourself, you see it. Nobody's telling you. You're having your own ahas and realizations, like, every day.
Yeah.
To guide you. And that's just very powerful.
Yeah. What you said is, thank you. That when you recognize that it's working, it just encourages continued joyful engagement. And so then even a bad day or a bad situation, you recognize this is simply an opportunity to continue to awaken.
Right.
And that's all it is.
Right. Where was I in thought, word, and deed in that moment?
Yeah.
In that situation? Was I justifying? What was I doing?
And then you recognize that the Eightfold Path is the way of getting back on the path. And you said something about it, so it was sweet, and that's, when you read the suttas, and like we're able to experience here, you really get an understanding of this human being, don't you?
Yeah.
As a strong but incredibly sweet and compassionate human being, because it comes through every one of his teachings, even when he's being stern and direct with someone, it's rooted in wisdom and compassion, in that sweetness that comes from understanding, from having a fully developed conscience. Thank you. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here. I like anything that gets you on the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
I'm particularly fond of the Eightfold Path. and these are just, like more mile markers along the way.
Yeah.
They're 10th mile markers.
That's good.
Mile markers. They're just other little guideposts. And I like that conviction is in there, because if you start with conviction, it helps you to hang in there. If you commit to be convicted to your goal, it helps. helps you to hang in there even when it seems difficult, or you catch yourself, you know, stepping off the path, or you find yourself in a situation around people who are not on the path, and, you know, gives you the ability to disengage from unskillful behavior, or just perhaps in a subtle way influence unskillful behavior.
Oh, yeah.
So they're just, yeah, they are sweet reminders of where you want to be.
I like that phrase, fond of the Eightfold Path. That's pretty good. Thank you, Alan. Rory, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to be here, yeah. Thanks. Just observing tonight.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you're here.
To be here.
Yeah. It's great to have you as part of our Sangha. Russ, good to see you.
Hi.
I really appreciate that you fly in from California.
I really appreciate being here.
Thank you for joining us. Frank, good to see you.
Good to be here. Welcome to our Sangha, Natalie.
Here
in California. So it's really cool what everybody had to share tonight. And I like what Helen said about like the mile markers and like that really hits the chord with me, because everything that I'm learning is kind of like, it's not something to be attained like that. It's more like something for reflection, questions to ask myself to show me where I'm at with everything. And it brings me right back to right view and like where my intention is, you know. And when I look at the virtuous part of the path, really want to see how I'm doing. I'm just starting a vacation here with my family. I can just check in with the agitation level with my travel partners, my wife, and my children. And we haven't even gone anywhere yet. I don't know about this. And I'm like, okay, this could be a tough month, a tough July. But, like, so how am I doing with it all? So, being in the moment, mindfully aware of right speech and intention, and with the right understanding of where I'm at, could bring, if it brings about a little bit more wisdom, then I think that it would be a lot less painful for myself and for everyone. But one thing I want to say, I was down the shore. My sister will never listen to this.
Speak freely.
So, we were raised by
this is gonna be great.
a German father, just like from the old land, you know what I mean? Like, very tough. And great grandfather, grandfather, father. And he raised all four of us the same way. And I had an opportunity to spend in my father's house for a few days with my brother Cass, so my siblings. And after a couple days, I took a walk last night with my wife and my son, and I was like leaning out, looking out at the ocean, and my son said, "What's up?" And I said, "I mean, I like anything like that at all, like, because like, you don't really get to see yourself." I'm like, especially from years ago, like when I first started coming here, I know how crazy I was, but I'm like, man, like my heart breaks for you guys if I was anything like that. I'm like, I got some amends to make. And I'm not saying that in any way to like bash on anybody with wrong speech, but it's just like the conditioned thinking, the being open to a different way, letting go of everything that I thought that I knew, and just being open to something new. What you can learn.
hang on to those.
Phew. What a powerful amends too, but your continued mindful presence for your family. I mean, I know you're
shifting the DNA.
Yeah.
Gotta do something. Breaking the chain.
But this, again, what you just said is just such a good example of how this works to bring peace in the world, doesn't it? And it all of it starts locally. It has to. I mean,
the change.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Thank you, Frank. Liz, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you too. The thing that I keep thinking of throughout this whole conversation is karma, and how, you know, Frank is talking about breaking the chain, and Mary's talking about noticing things in the moment, and the shift that takes place that's going to make your future self in a better place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always the choices, the decisions we make, like Lorna always says about the tip of the arrow, you're in this moment, you know, make these choices.
Mm-hmm.
And then now you're in this moment, and what choices are you going to make? And so that's what I keep thinking of when, so these aren't just things to make us feel good about ourselves, but there's so much more of a trajectory of all this as you walk through your life. And what is your definition of karma? Present moment?
The present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the current level of mindfulness.
That's the important part.
The right
current
yeah.
level of mindfulness. Yeah.
So all of the skillful use, this is reiterating the skillful use of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and then to watch your future self unfold in moments that you might have reacted differently in the
yeah.
past, but now that you have a more skillful use of all of this information, you can start to recognize that maybe your karma has shifted a little bit, and you're not, you know, getting hit by the same bus.
Yeah.
You've stepped out of the way.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden it's like, yeah. So that's my discernment slash insight.
It's great insight, Liz, because it's a great understanding of karma. It's not, karma isn't some inevitable thing. It's something that we have complete control over by how we're thinking in this moment. And that's the radical difference between the common view of karma during the Buddha's time and the way he taught it. Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you too. You know, I keep thinking of what everybody's talking about, what we've been talking about. It's like, and especially seeing it like a philosophically or not religiously, it's a framework for self-reflection.
Yeah.
We know we have a choice, like, and it's sometimes it's not easy to see. So, you know, for, like you said, it's like reflection. And then, because I think insight isn't enough. I mean, a lot of people have insight, but it doesn't mean that it leads us to making changes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think certainly we don't have any choice if we don't reflect, if we don't not just reflect on what everybody else is doing, but what I'm doing, and how is going to keep bringing the same stuff to myself, because I keep doing the same thing. But like Frank's moment when you were talking, I love, not love those moments, but when all of a sudden you get some sort of clarity, and you can sort of step away from it a little bit, and but I think what a lot of people would say tonight is that it's also, you know, it is work to constantly bring, you know, skillful view to its work. You know, to when things are going good, it's good. But then when all of a sudden it's like, whoa, you know, what was that? Oh, that was, right, that was me.
The bus.
Yeah, that was me. That was me, right. You did that, and then you got that thing, and so if you don't want to get that, then, so, yeah, I love that idea, and it's been really useful and helpful with me and my livelihood to have a, such a, you know, there's so many psychological philosophies and methods, and I used to go to these workshops and conferences and hear people very clearly using those frameworks, and I think I apply as it demands in my work, but this application, you know, this whole framework has been just really nice to keep learning, like, you know, at a certain age that you think, like, you know, that you can keep learning and deepening your knowledge of where you are and who you are and who you want to become, so.
Thank you for that, Bonnie. Without putting words in your mouth, the Eightfold Path is the framework for self-reflection then.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
that's
then,
really what it is, isn't it?
And then, like, you know, I was thinking everything that people say, they were spending a lot of time together, like the signposts and all the ways in which, like, they're reminders of what happens if we do this, or that these opportunities present themselves if you keep these things in mind. I think it's someone who is on the path it's got to be self-reflective, and
yeah.
You can't do this otherwise. And sometimes that's frustrating to me if you know that people are really clinging and craving to you know, the past, and so how to be patient and present to say, so it is a choice.
Yeah.
It is a choice.
Yeah, it is, and even these five strengths point to how to do that with people,
right.
with conscience and concern. And, yeah. It's just practical advice. Thank you.
You're
Natalie, good to see you tonight.
Hi,
glad you could join us. It was, you know, connecting the dots between different thoughts and feelings and patterns and patterns of behavior that it just never ends. You can always justify your actions, blame it on somebody. You know, I'm this way because of my genetics. It's epigenetics. It's ancestral. It's there's no end. You know, it's historical. So this was really helpful for me because it allowed me, in the suttas, in the Dhamma Sutra, taught me tonight about this recurring theme, this reflection, self-reflection. Like my mom said, the mile markers. Just seeing these five strengths was like a good check to see where I'm at in my process, and not that I'm necessarily even jumped far off the path, because I Thank you, Natalie. That was just beautiful, and it you showed great insight in seeing the difference.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't mean that one thing is worse. It's a different practice with different goals and different results.
It's funny. It's called emotional freedom technique.
Yeah. Well, but you can see that again, not to denigrate it, but the difference is that it's objectifying your mind to the past.
Yeah.
It has an aspect of grasping because of that. You know, where, how do I connect all this? Rather than what the Buddha's teaching is to be just present with what's occurring in your mind. David
mm-hmm.
mentioned this. It's what's arising and it's what's passing away, and to recognize the impermanence of it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, on the website there's recordings of this meditation and some other teachings that you might find helpful.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you joined us.
You might like last Saturday's, because that was about traveling in your mind. You know?
Rohitasa Sutta,
okay,
yeah.
She uses exactly the same words.
That's right, yeah.
Traveling.
Rohitasa asked the Buddha, who was, he was involved in some mystical practices, even though he was a student of the Buddha, is it possible to travel outside of your mind to seek the end of the cosmos, which is really to seek the end of suffering. And so the Buddha said yes and no. it's all an inside job. You can't be traveling in a figurative or a literal sense.
Yeah.
That it's done here on our cushion by developing and integrating the Eightfold Path. And that's the one thing that set the Buddha's teachings apart during his time, and I think it's the one thing that sets it apart 2,600 years later. And the, you know, not that it needs proof, but the proof is this simple little sutta, how powerful it was for all of us, but also for Natalie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it just astonishes me how efficient and powerful this man's words were then in 2,600 years later. Liz.
As I was listening to Natalie, I was really anticipating what you were going to say to her, because one of the things that's been a great relief to me is that there's nothing mystical and magical about this, so you can kind of lay that down along the side and know that something as simple and practical as what the Buddha taught, we always say it's simple but not easy.
Yeah.
But it's very practical. It's very, it sort of recognizes in many, many ways over time what the distractions are.
Yeah.
And when you start to feel it, when you start to integrate it, you start to feel it, you know, that you're physically moving towards something that's a distraction. Your voice raises and you're into a distraction.
Yeah.
You know, you're, I don't know, just your the way you live through life, you start to see it in yourself and see it in other people as you move through life, what those distractions are, and then learning how to lay those distractions down so that you can, you know, move through the world a little more skillfully.
Yeah. Wow, that's a good line to end it on, huh? Move through the world a little more skillfully.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Liz. Happy 4th of July, everyone, those in the United States. We'll finish with metta, as we always do, the Buddha's words on metta. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the words of the Buddha on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a remarkable class tonight. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.